emerging markets are usually the first ones to get cut off from the source of funding. All of a sudden, American banks, your Bank of America's, your JP Morgan's, your Citibank, start to focus more at home. And, you know, and they say, why do I need to invest in Indonesia? Why do I need to invest in Chile? And so the dollars run scarce, and those countries go through liquidity squeezes and crisis. What is very telling is that we had a liquidity crisis in 2022. US dollars shot up, markets went down, and emerging markets were fine.
This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Goldrock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice.
Okay, so welcome to the Definitely Uncertain podcast by Goldrock Capital. My name is David Ram, and I'm a partner at Goldrock Capital, the more than 20-year-old multifamily office servicing high net worth investors in Israel and around the world. And with me today is Louis Gav, CEO of GavCall, one of the world's leading independent providers of global investment research, headquartered in Hong Kong. Welcome, Louis.
Thanks. Thanks a bunch, David. I must say, I love the title of the podcast, Definitely Uncertain. I wish I'd come up with it. It's a terrific title.
Yeah.
That's how I feel. I lead my life. I'm definitely uncertain about 100% of the time.
Exactly. So it's funny. My partner, Darren, came up with that title in like March, April of 2020, you know, when COVID hit, and we had no idea what the hell was going to happen in the future. And a couple of years ago, or maybe a year ago, we're like, should we rename the podcast? Because, you know, now everything is certain. And like, we're still definitely uncertain.
Definitely uncertain.
Nothing's changed.
There's so many things you can definitely be uncertain about today. Obviously, the geopolitical strife is one of them. The demographic transition, whether our monetary order stays the same, or whether we're in a period of transition, where we head into energy. So many different things to be uncertain about.
Absolutely. I mean, you touched on so many there. And you know, one of the things I've always appreciated about you, Louis, is your perspective on that relationship between the West and the East, you know, the emerging markets in the U.S. in particular, and all those geopolitical elements. You know, you mentioned things around population shifts, you know, China versus U.S. You know, Israel is, which one of the most interesting things about Israel is that Israel is, I think, the most babies per family in the West by a large margin. We're three. On average, three per family.
I was going to say, that's like being the tallest dwarf. having the most babies in the West. Having the most babies in the West is a pretty easy bar to clear.
Yeah.
But well done. No.
But yeah. But we're in growth mode without immigration requirements, I guess you could say. Yeah. So that's the difference. But yeah. So maybe as a starting point, Louis, you can give a quick intro on yourself in more detail, and then we can start talking about those aspects that you mentioned.
Yeah, no, look, thanks for having me. My name's Louis Gav. I'm the founding partner and CEO of a company called GavCall. We're headquartered in Hong Kong, as you mentioned. We started off as a macro research firm with, you know, a pretty simple idea that China's emergence into the global economy was a really big deal, and most people weren't paying enough attention to it. This is sort of 25 years ago. And therefore, there was, you know, a sort of gap to fill in the market where we felt, you know, China's going to be very important for Western investors, and maybe we can explain to people what's happening there. And from there, we grew a money management business. So we run a few funds and some institutional mandates. And then we also bought a couple of private wealth businesses, one in the US and one more recently in Mauritius. So we've sort of grown in different directions. And what started as an operation that was really three men and a dog, it was my father, myself, and our very good friend Anatol Kaletsky.
Who I assume is the Cal. He's the Cal of GavCall?
He's the Cal and GavCall, exactly.
Okay, gotcha.
And from that embryo, we've now grown to being sort of eight partners, about 100 employees. In different offices, but the main offices remain the office in Hong Kong and Beijing and then Singapore. So we are very Asia-centric.
Got you. Interesting. So maybe we can jump right into the geopolitics a little bit, where I think one of the measurements around geopolitics can often be in currency. I'm not sure if you agree with that, but I look at currency movements and interactions between currencies since it's a more of a relative trade, right? It's not a standalone value. It's related to something else. So when you look at things that are being purchased, it was US dollar was the main international currency for trade. Is that changing? It seems to be changing a little bit more recently, especially with the Ukrainian invasion.
Look, I think that's the single most important question right there. And this definitely uncertain world that we live in, for me, that is the biggest question. There's no doubt that since World War II, we've lived in a US dollar world, right? Most global trade was funded in US dollars. Most capital spending was funded in US dollars. And the question is whether this is changing. Now, the argument against it changing is that no currency comes close to offering the sort of rule of law, the military presence, the everything that the US dollar offers, yeah. Right? And that it's therefore very hard to see anything replace the US dollar. I would agree with that. Over the years, I've written a lot of papers arguing that currencies are like a computer operating system. I'm going to go out on a whim and say that you probably use Microsoft. And the reason you use Microsoft in your firm is that everybody else uses Microsoft. Yep. Therefore, when you want to hire somebody new, you can assume that they know how to use Excel and you know how to use PowerPoint. When you want to transfer a file to me, it's easy. And currencies are the same. Everybody uses the US dollar because everybody uses the US dollar. It sort of becomes self-fulfilling. And to change, you're never going to give up Microsoft unless something comes up that's miles better, right?
That's right.
And again, nothing really comes close. Now, using this Microsoft analogy, what you have seen in recent years is, of course, in the past 20 years, is Apple sort of challenge Microsoft, right? And gain some market share. And it did it by going straight to the consumer. The way Apple did it was by developing a new product, first the tablet, then the smartphone, and bypassing the corporate IT departments. And I think this is somewhat what the renminbi is trying to do. It's trying to go to new consumers, places like Indonesia, like the Philippines, like South Africa, places that, didn't really matter in the whole global economic landscape, and say, hey, look, instead of staying dependent on the US dollar, try out the renminbi. And it is gaining some traction.
And that requires probably a very low volatility, I can only assume, right? You have to have very stable value.
Yes.
And it has to be related to something. So how does someone in South Africa, for example, measure? First of all, I thought you were giving a pitch for crypto, but put that aside with the whole Apple story there. But if someone in South Africa is using the RMB, how do they relate to that currency in terms of the stability of that value? How do they relate to it? To gold? To dollar? I mean, how would they do that?
I think they relate it to the total return of the currency, indeed, still relative to the US dollar. Mm-hmm. And this is where it gets very interesting, is if you look at the total returns of Chinese government bonds and the total returns of US treasuries, really for the period, let's say 2010, which is when China really starts to sort of think of opening up its capital accounts and lets foreigners start to accumulate Chinese government bonds, 2010 to 2019, 2020, it's exactly the same performance as US treasuries. I mean, give or take a few percent, they're like tracking each other. And in the past 3 years, the gap has opened up massively. While U.S. treasuries have obviously puked in the past couple of years, you've seen Chinese government bonds continue to deliver extremely steady and positive returns.
I assume that's QE. I assume that's Chinese quantitative easing, no?
I think it's actually the fact that the Western world has followed extremely, extremely inflationary policies during COVID. We let budget deficits absolutely explode in the US and Europe and most countries. Yeah. And we funded this explosion in budget deficits through money printing. I mean, money supply growth in the US was during the COVID years, M2 growth reached 26%. That's the kind of stuff bond markets don't like. The explanation is pretty simple. Inflation in Europe, inflation in the US is 6, 7, 8, 9%, pick your number, and inflation in China is 2%. So you know, that has an impact on bonds. I don't think we need to overcomplicate things.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, if you're a South Africa, if you're a Indonesia, you start to wonder, okay, where should I keep my reserves?
Yeah.
Should I keep my reserves in a country that's running budget deficits of 5% a year and funding those through money printing? Or should I keep those in China? And yes, China comes with a lot of geopolitical risk and question marks and et cetera, no doubt about it. But at this stage, when you look at the policy settings that are unfolding in the Western world, yeah, the inability to get budget deficits under control, the inability to get money supply to basically fund these deficits outside of central banks printing, you know, this is a scenario emerging markets know very well. You know, if you work at the Indonesian central bank, if you work at the Brazilian central banks, if you work at the South African central banks, this is what you've had to deal with your entire career. Runaway budget deficits funded by money printing. This is your typical emerging market policy mix. And now you're seeing, you know, what you used to bemoan in your own country, you're seeing it in the US, you're seeing it in Europe. So I think you are looking for alternatives.
Interesting.
And so at the margin, yeah, I think that does lead to some flows into RMB. But then on top of this, and sorry, I'm speaking a long time, you have this massive wrench thrown in the global financial machinery,
yeah,
with this Ukraine war,
yes,
right? All of a sudden, you get this game changer where the Western world, you know, decides, okay, Russia goes out and invades Ukraine. How do we respond? And the way we respond is we say we're going to confiscate not only the assets of the Russian central banks and the Russian government, but we're going to confiscate the assets of all the Russian oligarchs.
Right.
Right.
Chelsea.
And yeah. Chelsea football club,
yep,
you know, Saint-Tropez houses, yachts, private jets, you name it. We're taking it. And that, I think, if you're sitting in an emerging market, comes as a huge shock. It comes as a huge shock because you've always invested in things like U.S. treasuries on the premise that this was the ultimate safe asset.
Yeah.
And now, all of a sudden, the U.S. government tells you this is a safe asset depending on who you are, right? Which is a paradigm shift for the Western world, because the Western world was based on the premise, and I'm not saying that we always respected this, but it was at least based on the belief that everybody's equal in front of the law, right? That you can be black, brown, white, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Hindu. When you go in front of a court of law, you get the same fair shake.
Mm-hmm.
And now we add a little asterisk to this. We say, except
no
if
Russians,
you're Russian.
Right.
Except if you're Russian. If you're Russian, we can just take your stuff without court orders, without debate in parliament. And we can do this because your leader's a jerk, right?
Right.
We can do this because your leader's a jerk. But this is deeply problematic. I mean, in legal terms, because, you know, the whole point of Judeo-Christian society is you don't get condemned for the sins of your father. You get condemned for your own sins. You don't get condemned for somebody else's sins.
Right.
So here, all of a sudden, I'm a rich Russian guy, and I get condemned because of the sins of Vladimir Putin.
But it's not like equity and credit spreads have tightened between emerging markets and Western world as a response to that. In other words, the risk profile, you know, as an asset allocator ourselves, when we look at regional risk, we look,
yes,
at rule of law. Rule of law is, especially when I'm thinking about private assets and longer term investment holds, you know, I have a very short list of countries that I'm going to invest in. No offense to you personally. I'm not sure if you're French. I'm guessing you are. Are you French originally?
I'm French. I'm,
okay,
French,
I'm not, yeah, investing in French private equity. Okay. We had a bad experience there where all of a sudden the capital,
hey, we're
structure,
all the fruits of our own experiences.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you have the equity, which is owned by the pensioners, and the debt, which is owned by hedge funds. You know, the courts decide equity comes first because it's pension money as opposed to hedge fund money. You know, rule of law is out the door. You know, and frankly, I spoke to a hedge fund manager that we're invested in, and I'm like, where's the worst region you've ever invested in? And you know what he told me? This is about 5 years ago. He told me the U.S., because the U.S. changed the rule on the Puerto Rican bonds.
Yes.
Midstream. Yeah. So rule of law has always been a challenge everywhere, I assume. It's not only, you know, I guess it was,
yeah,
it was pronounced, perhaps.
I was about to say that exactly that. It was extremely, extremely visible. And it was extremely pronounced. So now, you know,
so again, now if you're Chinese, you're not going to be buying that 50th story penthouse in Manhattan anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. Because you think, okay, well, my leaders are jerk too. You know,
right.
And I know it's like, so tomorrow they can decide because Xi Jinping's a jerk, I lose my stuff in the West. And the very reason I was buying stuff in the West was because my leader's a jerk, right? Yeah. The reason I bought this house in Vancouver is it's my fail-safe money. It's my go-to place in case things go bad. Hmm. And now you tell me if things go bad, I take it away from you. Well, then this house isn't what I thought it was.
Right.
But to your point, you know, there's only so many places you can invest, et cetera. I want to bring you back a year, exactly a year ago when Russia invades Ukraine, right?
Yes.
And if, you know, if we'd had this conversation and if I had said to you, look, over the coming year, the Fed is going to be, put yourself back 12 months ago.
Yeah.
The Fed is going to be much more hawkish than anybody expects. They're going to raise 400 basis points. As a result, the US dollar is going to go up 20%. Global equity markets are going to go down 20%. Oh, and by the way, to add insult to injury, China's going to like lock down hard. And Shanghai, their main economic hub, is going to be completely shut down for 2 months. Like nothing coming in and out of the airport, nothing coming in and out of the port, et cetera. Okay. This is going to be the landscape. So if I were you, I would go out and buy a bunch of Brazilian bonds. And I'd go out and buy South African bonds. And I'd go out and buy Indonesian bonds because they're going to outperform everything. You would have looked at me and you would have said, you're an imbecile.
Yeah.
You're a halfwit. Don't you know that in a Fed tightening cycle, you don't buy emerging markets, you sell them? Don't you know that when China does badly, emerging markets...
Explain why that is. Why is it when the West tightens, emerging markets are bad? Why is that? I mean, historically, well, you're talking about, I assume.
Yeah. Well, look, because of the very reason we were discussing earlier, I think historically, look, most capital spending in emerging market is still priced in US dollars. Most funding for big projects, but also all the trade. Energy input. Anything of note has historically been priced in US dollars. So when those US dollars become scarcer and become more expensive, which is what happened in 2022, emerging markets are usually the first ones to get cut off from the source of funding. All of a sudden, American banks, your Bank of America's, your JP Morgan's, your Citibank, start to focus more at home. And, you know, and they say, why do I need to invest in Indonesia? Why do I need to invest in Chile? And so the dollars run scarce and those countries go through liquidity squeezes and crisis.
Hmm.
What is very telling is that we had a liquidity crisis in 2022. US dollars shot up, markets went down, and emerging markets were fine. So, you know, we're based in Asia, and in Asia, Indonesia is historically your sort of canary in the coal mine. It's the redhead stepchild that gets beaten up each time there's something bad that happens on markets. Last year, Indonesian equities were up and Indonesian bonds were up for the year.
Hmm.
This never happens in a global bear market. But yet it happened last year. So for
but
me, there's,
but
a, there's
half,
a very...
Half the emerging market index is probably China. China.
Yeah.
Got,
so if you strip out Chinese equities, actually, if you look at your EEM, you know, to your point, like 40% is China,
right?
Which did very badly.
Yes.
Because of the, you
of
know,
the lockdown.
They did lockdowns while everybody else was reaccelerating. But you strip that out, the rest of the emerging markets were fine. You know, Brazil was up for the year. Mexico was up for the year. India was up for the year. Indonesia was up for the year. And again, against the backdrop of strong dollar, weak China, tied to Fed, global bear market.
And when you say up, just to make sure we're talking the same language, you say up, you mean up in their local currency or in the US dollar denominations?
All of them were up in their local, well, not all of them, but most of them were up in their local currencies.
Right.
And then some were even up in US dollars. I mean, like Brazil was up almost double digit in US dollar terms.
Wow.
And, you know, that's obviously a pretty big one. Mm-hmm. You know, India, for all intents and purposes, was flat. Indonesia, you know, Singapore was up in US dollars.
Right. The UK was flat, I think.
UK, well, you know, the UK, interestingly, the UK is not a British market. You look at the composition of the FTSE 100.
It's energy and banking, essentially.
It's energy, banking, and it's BHP, Rio Tinto, it's mining.
Interesting.
It's not like when you buy, if you think you're buying the FTSE 100 and you're buying the UK economy, you're really not. And by the way, the banking, the biggest of them all is HSBC in there.
Right, Singapore,
so,
right. Mm-hmm.
So,
interesting.
So Look, I think there's something extremely important going on. And this is the single most important question. And I'm not saying I have the answer, but at least, you know, we have to be definitely uncertain about this, is that the big question is this, is are we witnessing a shift in our global monetary order? Now, I'm sure your readers have read some of Zoltán Pozsar's from Credit Suisse reports. And, you know, I've written a couple books about this in the past couple of years. One written in 2019 was called Clash of Empires. Another one written last year was called Avoiding the Punch. It's the single most important question. And if you think that, no, US dollar is still the king, you can continue investing as you've always had. But if you think that we're moving to a world, now that we've decided in our collective wisdom to cut Russia off, Russia, the world's biggest producer of commodities, to cut them off from the US dollar system, hereby forcing them to do deals in renminbi and do deals in rupees and do deals in Korean won. Now that we forced Russia to do this, is this a paradigm shift? And
I think it's right. You have the Russians, you have the Iranians who are still some of a rogue nation also selling a lot of oil to the Indians and others, and of course China. So it's, the axis of evil, is that brand is coming back in style apparently.
It's bigger now. It used to be Iran, Iraq, and North Korea.
That's right.
So, you know, not doesn't matter that much.
Right.
Russia, China, you know, those are bigger players.
Absolutely, they're much more meaningful players. You know, you mentioned something earlier which is really compelling, which is around the taking away the assets of the Russians. And one thing I've always worried about is, you know, the Chinese are obviously watching Russia invade Ukraine, the Western response. Everyone seems to assume that they have their eye on Taiwan for various reasons. And I always thought, like, okay, let's say they invade Taiwan. What's going to be the Western response in terms of regulatory response, or, you know, not allowing us to buy Chinese everything? Like, everything we own is Chinese, essentially. As opposed to Russia, which was like a 2%, 3% input into the U.S. economy, which is a pretty easy, you know, just ban Russian, you know, oil and gas. Okay, the Jones Act forces the U.S. to import some oil and gas into Boston, whatever. But besides for that, there's not a lot going on. So how is the Western response going to be even possible if the Chinese actually, they shouldn't be worried because we can't respond in the same format. Does that make sense? They're in a position of strength.
Yeah. I think we can't respond in the same format. First of all, because everybody signed up years ago to the One China policy. So Ukraine's a very different situation. Ukraine was a sovereign nation with a seat at the United Nations, with, you know, diplomats all over the world. You know, Taiwan is not that. Taiwan is a renegade province. Taiwan does not sit at the United Nations. So in terms of international law, it would be a completely different proposition. But having said this,
so you think they would let it go? The world would let it go.
I think if we wanted to let it go, there's at least that loophole. It's like, it's internal matters. You know, we could. Having said this, China is not invading Taiwan anytime soon.
No.
I don't think it's invading Taiwan. You know, there's you know, if you go back to World War II, when America won the war in Europe and started to concentrate on the Pacific, initially the U.S. said, you know, it was looking for land masses from which it could bomb Japan, and it looked to take Taiwan. And the U.S. Navy said, you know, that's not possible. It's a natural fortress. You know, Taiwan is 12,000 feet peaks that fall in the water. There's really only three beaches in Taiwan on which you can do an amphibious landing. It's literally cliffs. It's like, it's impregnable. And those three beaches that you could potentially land on, you know, that's easy enough to defend. And that's why, if you look at Taiwan, you would think that along with Israel, Taiwan would be having huge military budgets, that it would put all of its men and women as well under the flag and for military training. You know, all the things that you guys are accustomed to, Taiwan would be doing the same. And you would be very surprised that it is absolutely not the case. You know, for the past 15 years, the Taiwan defense budget has been cut every single year. They've cut down the military service, I think, from 12 months to down to 4 months. And, you know, I don't know if you served in the military in Israel, like, you know, I served in the military in France. In 4 months, you don't get to do very much.
Right.
You get to learn how to walk. You get to learn how to walk in rhythm and salute and learn the ranks. And that's about it.
Yeah. I was drafted and they told me, we'll call you if we need you. And they haven't called yet. But if they do call, we're in big ass trouble.
You're the bottom of the barrel.
Exactly. No, it's interesting you say that because obviously China could press a button and end Taiwan, but that would kind of defeat the purpose.
Yeah. China can destroy
and,
Taiwan.
Right. That would be, but that's worth, that's a worthless event. Who cares?
They can nuke it for sure.
They can bomb
the hell out of it. But what's the point? And here, this is an important point. There is no fundamental massive bad blood between China and Taiwan. You know, there is no, we really hate those guys. You know, if you look at the Ukraine situation, part of the Russian rhetoric is that the Ukrainians were shelling the Russians in the Donbass and there'd been 10,000 deaths in the Donbass and that Russia had to intervene to protect their own and that, you know, Ukraine was making the Russian language illegal, et cetera. There was a lot of bad blood. You know, there was a lot of bad blood in this region. You don't have any of those passions at all in Taiwan. You know, there isn't the belief that, oh, the Taiwanese government is preventing people in Taiwan from speaking Chinese or from living their lives or that they're even killing people. There is none of that. Mm-hmm. So there is sort of none of this sense of urgency of we need to act because we need to protect our people that you had in Russia. And so, look, the whole Taiwan story, you can look at it. I have a great chart on this. If you Google the term Taiwan, and you look at the Google News trends, it's basically nowhere until the U.S. left Afghanistan. The week the U.S. leaves Afghanistan, all of a sudden Taiwan becomes this big issue. And the reason it does is the week the U.S. leaves Afghanistan, Biden does a 60-minute interview, and he's asked the question, oh, look, with the shamble in Afghanistan, doesn't that give China the green light to invade Taiwan?
Yep.
And that's when he first says, no, we'll protect Taiwan, which is like a big departure from what the U.S. has always said. And then all of a sudden, it becomes an issue when it really wasn't much of one before.
Right.
So, look, I think there's basically two red lines for China. And China's always made this clear. The first red line is Taiwan can't declare independence. And here, I think the Taiwanese know this full well. And, you know, most Taiwanese people have no interest in becoming the next Ukraine. You know, they've got no interest in seeing their country absolutely destroyed. And you saw this very clearly at the last, nobody talks about this in the West, but in December, you had the municipal elections in Taiwan. And, you know, Taiwan, like most countries, is roughly split 50-50 politically. Split 50-50 between a Democratic Party that tends to be pro-independence and a KMT that tends to be, pro-China business. And now, what was interesting in these municipal elections is that instead of being 50-50, the Democratic Party got absolutely wiped out, absolutely smoked. So basically the message from the Taiwanese population was, hey, like we don't want to be Ukraine. Like let's turn it down.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what's the most likely outcome is that the next legislative elections, you know, which have to happen in the next year and a half, the KMT is going to sweep to power. And at that point, you know, all the provocations of the U.S., of let's send, you know, politicians every 2 months, rattle the cage, etc.
Yes.
That will stop. That will stop because the KMT government will say, no, thank you. Please don't come.
That's really interesting. And I would even point to the U.S. for a second. You know, the two major legislation successes, if you want to call them that, in the Biden administration so far is the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act. And the other one was... Yeah, exactly. $1.7 trillion
let's increase the budget deficit to reduce inflation.
Yeah, exactly. You always know what the bill is about when you just reverse the language every time. It's like that. So the IRA, and then the other one was the Semiconductor Act, which I forgot the name of it, but it probably is something backward as well. So those were the two major legislative successes. One being energy related, a lot of the IRA relates to renewable energy, massive gifts towards renewable energy. A lot of it, I think, will benefit the Chinese economy, frankly, around the EV market. Because
they produce 90% of the solar, of the solar cells.
Solar, wind, and electric vehicle technology is heavily skewed toward China.
Did you know, sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
Did you know that China is now the second largest car exporter in the world?
They have, I think there's like 30 or 40 models of Chinese EV companies. Come to Israel, we invite you, and you'll see most cars driving around are Chinese now. For the first time, I've never seen it like this before.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
half the it's cars the same on the road Chile. Now are Chinese. I've never seen it.
It's the same. It's the same across Latin America. So yeah. I just came back. I was in a few months ago, I was in Chile and Colombia and Peru, and I hadn't been there since before COVID.
Yeah.
And I was floored in just 4 or 5 years, all of a sudden, all the cars were Chinese.
Yeah. They built an enormous automotive industry, enormous, yeah. obviously. And apparently they're pretty good, these cars, at least for the first 6 months. We'll see how it goes after that. But but the second bill was the Semiconductor Act, which relates to deglobalization, the movements to say, oh, we're worried about the centralization of semiconductor manufacturing in Taiwan. You know, that's a major source of it, South Korea as well. And we're worried about the concentration level there. Let's bring it back home. So again, one benefits China, one was targeting China, those two bills. How do you see that in terms of the relationship between the U.S. and China? I got confused when I saw those two bills.
Yeah, look, I think a lot of the Inflation Reduction Act was about virtue signaling. It's, you know, let's spend a bunch of money and pretend we're doing something about climate change. And yes, without looking too much into second order effects, such as, you know, really a lot of this money is going to end up going to China for solar panels, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But we get the headlines we want. So that's my take on this. On the other one, on the Inflation Reduction Act, sorry, not the Inflation Reduction Act, on the Semiconductor Act. Mm-hmm. Look, I think the reality is...
Just to sharpen the question, I guess, sorry to cut you off. A lot of people are saying the new energy, if you want to call it that, is technology. Looking to the future, next 10, 20 years, whoever controls certain technology components is like an energy supplier in the 70s. Today, you know, oil and gas is dramatically less important in the economy than it used to be in the 70s and 80s, perhaps. It's still very, very important, but less. And perhaps in the future, semi is going to be critical, like computers, cars, everything that makes the world go around, essentially. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I think, look, let's go back 5 years. And I think if you were Xi Jinping, you know, you rolled out, you know, a fairly aggressive worldview where you basically said, look, you know, I've got this China dream and, you know, a One Belt, One Road and a Silk Road Fund and an Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. And in essence, the message you were sending out is that China's the new empire. And when I say empire, I don't mean that China's going to go out and invade everybody.
Yeah.
But the history of every empire is a road building exercise. You build roads to bring in the commodities cheaper and push out higher valued finished goods to the rest of the world. And that was China's vision. That was Xi Jinping's vision, right? You know, that in Europe, we say all roads lead to Rome because that's what the Roman Empire did, right? Build a bunch of roads to push out the goods and bring in the commodities.
That's right.
And so that was China's vision. And in laying this out, he was always going to clash with the United States. Now, it was unlikely that the U.S. would take this lying down. Now, and especially now, I think perhaps one mistake Xi Jinping made was he thought, okay, how is the U.S. going to fight back against it? Yeah. And I think he thought, I really have two weaknesses. The first, we discussed it, is my dependency on the U.S. dollar. So I have to internationalize the renminbi. I have to make it a strong and stable currency. I have to make it attractive to the likes of Indonesia, South Africa, et cetera. And so he pushed that very hard.
Yeah.
And that was a terrific opportunity to make money because for 10 years you could own Chinese bonds that offered much higher returns and much more stable returns than any other bond market. Yeah. Then I think he decided, okay, he thought through his weaknesses and he thought, okay, what's my other weakness? My other weakness is on energy. And so I need to build pipelines into Kazakhstan. I need to build a domestic solar industry. I need to do deals with Russia. And so, you know, he did all this. And then Trump comes to power, and I think Trump blindsided him. And Trump said, okay, no more semiconductors to China, or at least no more semiconductors to Huawei. And I think for Xi Jinping, that was a massive surprise, because there was a weakness there, a dependency on Western technology that I don't think he had anticipated. So the US with Trump basically says, we're going to confront China, and we're going to confront them on the field of technology itself. Once you start digging in, you realize the US has all the intellectual property, but all the factories, as you point out, are in Korea and Taiwan.
Right.
So if the US really wants to put the fight on there, the US isn't super strong either. It's not super strong either, because, you know, if the fight ever gets really bad, the US is going to lose access to semiconductors, you know, and I think that's the message that basically China passed on. It's like, well, if we can't have them, maybe we just bomb the TSMC site in Taiwan, and you can't have them either. And you can't have them either.
Oh boy.
And neither you nor I can have them.
If you won't love me, no one will.
Oh boy. So, you know, once the US decided we're going to put the fight against China on the scope of technology and the battlefield of technology, it has no choice but to bring that production back home. It can't leave it in Taiwan and South Korea. That's just too dangerous.
Right.
And then you come back to, okay, can the US do this? And here, you know, you listen to Maurice Chang, the founder of TSMC, and he keeps on, excuse my French, but bitching and wailing about how hard it is to build things in the United States, partly because the US doesn't have the workers that you have in Taiwan. It doesn't have the engineers that you have in Taiwan, or it doesn't have them at the same price at the very least. And so the whole, oh, we're going to build things in the United States, is also not proving that easy. But all in all, you come down to a simple story is, while the US does this, so the US decides, okay, I'm going to spend literally hundreds of billions of dollars to move an industry that was working very well in Taiwan and South Korea back to the US.
Yeah.
At the same time, the Chinese government says, well, I'm going to spend hundreds of billions of dollars to produce these things at home. And so you're left with basically a massive misallocation of capital. Both countries having to spend a lot more to, in essence, produce the same thing. And instead of living in an optimized world which is, you know, deflationary, because you optimize capital and so you don't, there's limited waste. Now, all of a sudden, you're massively increasing waste all across the spectrum by doubling your efforts. And that brings me, and I'm sorry to be long-winded on this, but my friend Luke Groman has a great line. He says that if truth is the first casualty in wars, the second casualty is bonds. You know, wars are always inflationary. You know, you end up misallocating capital. You end up having to spend too much money on very unproductive things. And at the end of the day, you're trying to destroy the other guy's productive capacity in a war. So you end up with less capital. And so wars are massively, massively inflationary. Now, if really we are in this new Cold War between China and the US, let's not kid ourselves that this is inflationary. Now, the reality is, who can least afford inflation today? Is it the US or is it China? I think that's an open question.
Yeah. I think the US sometimes appreciates inflation by the mere fact that their treasuries can decrease in value. And that's a good way to pay off that $31 trillion of debt. But I know your time is of short. And that last segment, you know, maybe you can bring it home a little bit to us, Louis, about, you know, a good idea. If you give us one good investment idea on the liquid market side that you're talking about to your clients for 2023, 2024, you know, the US is down 20%, the equity markets in 2022, it's obviously bounced back quite a bit already this year. If I just do the math, you know, on discount rates for future cash flow, I think the drop in markets are pretty rational. You know, went from zero cost of capital to a 4 or 5% annualized cost of capital. Just on that alone, a 20% drop is quite rational. So maybe, you know, priced to perfection, as they say in the US, I'm not sure. So what are you thinking about in terms of the equity markets, the bond markets, gold? What are you thinking about in terms of a one idea in the liquid markets in response to this interesting dynamic of a possible Cold War between the East and the West.
All right, I'm going to make like a rabbi and answer your question with another question.
Okay, I like that's a good one.
jokes aside.
Yeah,
like bear markets are there for a reason. Yeah, I think we are in a bear market. They're there for a reason. They're not fun, but they're there for a reason. That's to transfer the leadership from one major idea to another. So if you look through the history of financial markets, every 7 to 10 years, you have one idea that drives the market. So in the 1970s, the idea was there won't be enough for everyone. It was the Club of Rome, it was peak oil, et cetera. And by 1980, 35% of the S&P 500 was energy, and 6 of the top 10 market caps in the world were energy stocks. Mm-hmm. In the 1980s, it was Japan. Right? Japan was the big idea. If you and I didn't learn Japanese, we'd never have another job. And 8 out of the top 10 market caps in the world were Japanese companies.
Yeah.
Japan was 45% of the world MSCI. 1990s, it was the birth of the internet. 2000s, it was the emergence of China. 2010, it was the idea that software eats the world. And that, you know, you had to be in US growth stocks. That was the only place to be. And if you look, you know, in 2021, if you looked at your top 10 market caps in the world, 10 out of 10 were tech stocks. And I'm counting Tesla as a tech stock and Amazon as a tech stock, but like, loosely tech. And 8 out of 10 were in the U.S.
Yes.
The two exceptions were Tencent and TSMC. So the bear market has started, and it is concentrating on these names. The question is, so that's where I'm being the rabbi, answering your question with another question. What is going to be the big theme for the next 7 to 10 years? I tend to think the next big thing, I think we'll be back to a theme of commodities. We'll be back to a theme of emerging markets growth. And this, because I'm a structural bear on the US dollar, given everything that's unfolded. But I also think that for a number of reasons, we've massively underinvested in commodity extraction of all kinds, whether it be energy, whether it be metals. And I think this bull market has started. And while you're in a bear market, as unpleasant as it is, while things are falling, you have to look where you're seeing the outperformance, because that's usually a guide of to where the next bull market is going to take place. And if you look through last year, amidst fears of a global slowdown, amidst, again, all the conditions that should have led emerging markets to puke, emerging markets did very well and energy did very well. If you were positive last year, that was the only way you made money. You were either long energy or long emerging markets.
And it's hard to do both, because usually emerging markets gets hurt with high energy prices. They are very reliant.
Yeah, so some of them do, like India gets smoked, et cetera, but it didn't happen. So I think this is your structural trend. Now, within this structural trend, there's a second cyclical element that's shorter term. And for me, the big question for the next 12 months is, what happens to the literally hundreds of billions of dollars of savings in Chinese accounts, both onshore and offshore? Because Chinese entrepreneurs, for all the talk of deglobalization and friendshoring and reshoring, through COVID, Chinese exports to the US grew by $30 billion a month to $50 billion a month. As we were just discussing, all of a sudden you're seeing Chinese cars in Israel.
Yeah.
You're seeing Chinese cars in Chile and in Brazil. Like, who would have bet on that 5 years ago?
Yeah.
So on the other side of this is massive amounts of money flowed to China during the COVID years.
Yeah.
And they did nothing with it. They sat on it because for 3 years, all people could do was go to work and go home. They didn't go to the movies. They didn't go to buy a car, because what's the point? You can't drive anywhere. You didn't buy an LVMH handbag, because what's the point? You were stuck at home. You can't show it off to your girlfriends. So you have literally hundreds of billions of dollars sitting in offshore accounts and onshore accounts that belong to Chinese people.
And they don't want to buy their next house in Vancouver anymore, as you pointed out earlier.
And they're not going to buy their house in Vancouver, Sydney, or London anymore. So I think that money is going to go either into domestic consumption. And I think that's why LVMH is making new highs and Hermes are making new highs every day. So that's one option. It's going to go into tourism. But I think a good bunch of it is going to go into the few markets that remain open and welcome to Chinese money. And that is
neutral.
Singapore, that is, yeah, neutral. That's Singapore, that's Dubai, that's Hong Kong. So I think, look,
Israel. Israel, by the way.
Singapore is probably about the size of your living room. You know, it's a very tiny place, and there's going to be a lot of money coming into that tiny place. So I think we're going to see the greatest real estate bubble in history in Singapore. It's already starting, by the way. It's already ripping higher. I think Hong Kong real estate is going to rip higher again. You know, the big question for me is, where is that Chinese money going to go? And some of it will go into domestic real estate and domestic financial speculation. And you look at Chinese equities today, they're about as cheap as they've ever been, because 6 months ago, everybody decided China's uninvestable because they're about to invade Taiwan. And so I think that's the biggest gift horse you'll ever be given. But yet everybody's looking at the gift horse in the mouth saying, well, yeah, but what about Taiwan? And Xi Jinping's a jerk, et cetera. But, you know, you don't get very,
and it's
very
a one-man
cheap
show. It's a one-man show. I guess it always was a one-man show, but it's a one-man show
it's
now.
It always was a one-man show, but you don't get very cheap things without a fair amount of hair on the legs. And, you know, I can't remember, maybe it was Sir John Templeton. It's you want to be invested in bad places with good people rather than investing in good places with bad people.
Right. That's why Russia, for example, has always been, forget the war, way before the war, has always been dramatically underpriced from a multiple perspective versus all of its peers, because it's run by a guy nobody wants. Exactly. nobody wants to invest there. That's great. That's really interesting. Interesting tip. Well, Louis, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I know your time is valuable.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Next time I'll have you on maybe soon, and we'll talk about demographics, which I think was another piece of this puzzle, which always confuses me when I forecast demographics in the U.S., China, Russia, etc. 50 years from now, where is everybody going to be? Maybe that will be the topic of our next discussion. But this has been great.
We'll probably all be dead.
I hope not, but yes.
I think I will be.
Oh no, definitely not.
I'll be 100 otherwise. Which
oh
would be
man.
A good,
well,
a
in
good
50
inning.
Years, yes, but we could, yes, absolutely. If anybody wants to learn more about you, Louis, where should they look? Are you on?
The best place to look is our website,
gavekal.com.
gavekal.com.
Got you.
That's I don't do very much on social media. So yeah, the best place is our website.
Better, it's better for your happiness.
Exactly.
But thank you so much for joining us. And thanks everybody for listening to the Definitely Uncertain podcast. And we'll see you next time. Bye bye.
Thank you very much.